You just wanted to hit the hammer.
Chris is really jealous of the gavel. Okay. Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/InForum, and you can follow the best of our speaker dialogue on Twitter with hashtag InForumSF. We're here tonight for Eating Nose to Tail, the Whole Animal Movement. I'm Marisa Gujana, co-founder of the Butchers Guild, and tonight I'm joined by Chris Cosentino, Ryan Farr, John Fink, and Tia Harrison. Chris Cosentino is executive chef and partner at Encanto, winner of Top Chef Masters, and a 2013 James Beard Award nominee. Ryan Farr is co-owner and chef and butcher at 4505 Meats in San Francisco. John Fink is chef and owner at The Whole Beast in the Bay Area. And Tia Harrison is co-founder of the Butchers Guild, co-owner of Avadano's Meat, and executive chef at Sociale in San Francisco restaurant. So let's get to it. I think the first thing that we should discuss is what exactly does it mean to be nose to tail? And these four panelists have businesses that really focus on serving nose to tail meats and purchasing nose to tail and doing the whole gamut. And it's an uncommon choice. You might not know that being in the Bay Area, but it is. So I want to start with Tia, who just wrote Butchery for Dummies. So she's done a lot of research on the meat industry of late. And can you walk us through why it's different, more complicated, more interesting, hopefully, to be a business that buys whole animals versus boxed meat?
Well, what makes it different is that for many, many years, what we've all been accustomed to in food service is buying boxed meats. If you, as a consumer, are purchasing meat from a supermarket, you've been buying boxed meats as well for, you know, as long as you've been out shopping. So in the last, you know, I'd say 8 years, chefs, I feel, really had a big influence on this because at some point they were always chasing the source. And that's easier to do with vegetables. Hard to do with fish still, but with meat, you know, when you decide to really go for quality and a local product, you end up sort of inherently being forced to purchase from small farms. The distribution of the meat is what makes it a little bit tricky, and because of that, a lot of small farms don't have the distribution capabilities, maybe the processing capabilities to sell you 12 strip loins, so you end up having to purchase the whole animal. And then because of that, chefs became very inspired with working and cooking that way because it just really makes sense from a creative standpoint. That also ended up working for people who are opening butcher shops like myself. We opened 6.5 years ago. When we did open, we didn't purchase all whole animals. We didn't know what we were doing exactly. We thought it was going to be really, well, I thought it was going to be really easy. And it was really hard. So I would say what it means is that when you are purchasing whole animals, you end up with a whole new set of problems from a business standpoint. And what's really inspiring and fun and interesting to me is seeing all of the people who are my colleagues and how they've been able to be successful and creative and thrive in that environment.
Ryan's business has been selling food at the farmer's market where you have sort of a controlled menu for several years. And he just opened a butcher shop in the Mission. And I'm wondering how sticking to a whole animal ethos, you know, if you've encountered any new challenges, if you're struggling with it, or if all of your experience makes it really easy to just to go to that model when now you have a counter where people sort of expect to find certain things every day?
Well, nothing's easy, but for us, you know, being at the farmers markets is a perfect way for to utilize the whole animal, just like if you're in a restaurant setting, because we would get the, you know, the steaks, pork chops, strips, whatever. And, you know, in the beginning, that was the hard part to kind of get rid of. It was the easy part was the trim, the not-so-used cuts. So for us to open a butcher shop where we're open 5 days a week, but starting next week we're open 6 days, you know, we're able to sell all these prime cuts and have more animals to go through. So we have now more trim for sausages and hot dogs and, you know, terrines or whatever we want to make. And a lot of what we do too is we do a lot of burgers. So if we do, you know, a whole beef, you know, 40% of that, give or take, is goes to the burgers. So it allows us to stay true to that and you know, utilize everything. So I guess the challenge in the beginning was trying to sell the ribeyes. And now we kind of took care of that by opening up a butcher shop.
Mm-hmm.
And this
did that create more of a problem for you, though, creating yourself more trim, even though you have the output for the ribeyes?
No, we still need more animals. Yeah,
really?
We still need more. So I mean, it's a tough time to kind of go into something else, but you know, the beef season, grass-fed beef season, just about to start, a couple weeks. So, you know, it's been tough because it's seasonal to get good beef, good fat for what we want to use. So we've just been kind of, you know, making it work with what we have, and so there's seasonality to everything that becomes challenging, but having a butcher shop is definitely a lot easier than carrying coolers around every day to the market, setting up tents and breaking it down, and then you get, you know. So we do a lot of other things that go through the animals. So
John is the whole beast. His business is in booths and very event based, and you're at Off the Grid and lots of music festivals and deeply in the dragging a cooler around kind of world. How does buying whole animals and sourcing locally and knowing the farm? I know that you go to every farm that you buy from. That's part of your business ethics. How does that help you to be successful?
Well, one of my main formulas is I cook the whole animal. So I kind of take a lot of the problems that are inherent with whole animals with a butcher shop or a restaurant right out of the equation. And also, I'm not a restaurant, even though I'm kind of being really forced into open up a restaurant, which is, I'm trying to do everything in my power not to. But so I cook a whole animal. Usually it's for a large group of people, so we can go through that. And, you know, it's a simple formula, but simple is actually is really hard. But that cooking the whole animal at an event, at a farm, at a winery, at Off the Grid, at these music festivals where we're really, you know, hitting a large population.
Where you're cooking 40 lambs in a weekend?
Yeah, like outside lambs, we went through 25 lambs. That was an Eat Reel's a big one, like 17 lambs we go through. So, but that's my formula, and it's been working for a little over 4 years. But it still presents its challenges. As you said, like schlepping coolers, running refrigerator trucks, buying refrigerator trucks.
Not for the faint of heart.
All that stuff. Mm-hmm. No. Yeah, it's a lot of work. But I think the reward for me is actually meeting the farmers, walking in their footsteps, checking out what they do. And, you know, you were talking about the box cuts. Being a restaurant chef, which I was, you know, I asked a lot of questions with the meat purveyors, but it was like, what farm did it come from? What's the name of the farm? What state? But that's, you know, those are the questions I asked. But like when I started the business, you know, going up to the farm and just by myself or with my son and really just, you know, seeing how they do it. And then they would give me some product to taste, and I was, you know, I was moved. It was there really is a difference with these heritage breed animals and the small to medium farms, you know, the whole beast kind of, you know, started from there.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sure many of you know that Chris is well known at Encanto for the dishes he prepares with offal, and it's become a specialty of his. And I'm sure that you have done a great deal of consumer education, as all of our panelists have. But I'm curious, when you won Top Chef Masters by making offal dishes, is that still shocking to your colleagues, like on a jury of your peers? Are they like, this guy's insane that he's making tripe right now? Like,
well, I think Top Chef Masters, I wasn't cooking for any of my peers. I mean, I was cooking for 16 food critics, which is your worst possible nightmare. You like wake up with sweats for that. And I was told I was crazy. I was told I was crazy by every single one of those food critics that I was making a grave error. My goal was to be who I am and do what I do and not hide behind anything and just cook what we cook. That's what I do. I wasn't going to make myself be something I wasn't just to win, because it isn't fair to the public. It isn't fair to my guests, for people that would come to the restaurant expecting to see some hoity-toity fancy food that you use tweezers to put down on, because that's not what I do. And my goal was to just put forth exactly what was asked of me, which was four dishes, four letters of something that meant something to me. Mm-hmm. And that's all it was about. So it didn't matter. I mean, if they did that to Tia, she would choose the dishes that meant four important things to her, the same thing across the board. Mm-hmm. Everybody would have cooked the four things that meant the most important things to them. Mm-hmm. You know, a thank you letter, a love you, a love letter, a letter to myself, and an apology. And those are the dishes that I chose for that. So that really, it wasn't about, you know, being, you know, shock value or different. It was just, it's what I do. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it would have been pretty interesting if I went in there and pulled some molecular gastronomy BS out of my butt and decided that's how I was going to try to win. And then everybody would have, you know, what's that? Mm-hmm. You know, do you like, I caught myself, yeah. I almost swear. that for me was just to be honest and true to who I am and, you know, being comfortable with that. And I think part of, for me, what we've done, and, you know, everybody here is talking about their different issues and problems and the benefits of what we have. I mean, between Boccolone and Encanto, buying whole animals has been, you know, the backbone of both. And part of the problem with that at Boccolone, I've got lard coming out my wazoo. I mean, I sell tubs of lard. I mean, it sounds silly and trivial, but, you know, I got a lot of lard. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. I mean, I don't have a fryer at the restaurant, so I'm not filling my fryer with lard. So we sell tubs of lard, or I make lard pie doughs, or, you know, there's only so much you can do with certain things. And I think, at the restaurant, it's how fast can you go through these animals. So we'll get two whole lambs a week from Don Watson. We'll age them for a week. So we're always having two hanging. So we're always aging an extra week. And, you know, how do you go through the cuts? You know, am I making sausage? Am I making treens? Is the offal coming with these animals, or do I have to special request it? And it's all this game of making it work and being not, I don't want to say creative, but thinking intelligently. We're not doing anything new. We're actually reintroducing what's dead in this country, which is buying a whole animal and using it accordingly. That's nothing new. I wouldn't say we're doing anything new. Would you agree?
I think, though, it's like a reversal of the creative process. And
yeah.
Because, I mean, I'm not a chef, but normally you would be taught in culinary school or whatever that you pick a menu and you call up your distributor and you order the ingredients.
Well, yeah, they
and
tell you to plan
different.
On your proteins.
Yeah.
Remember at culinary school, plan on your proteins. So you work backwards from your protein and then you find the seasonal vegetables and then you put it accordingly. Put your starch and put your pile of this and your sauce of that. You get your tweezers out. And I think that's what school was and that's what we were taught. And I know a bunch of the schools now, I know locally that Butchery's out. They took butchery out of one of the schools.
Yeah, we'll do classes at San Francisco Cooking School.
That's the new school. They have. But I know CCA took butchery class out because butchery instructor is now selling meat. He knocked at my door the other day. He's like, "Hey, Chris, you want to buy some?"
door.
It's interesting. I think it poses many problems, but many wonderful options too. I mean, when you give a chef a whole animal, it's like going from having black and white when you're a painter to then saying, hey, here's a full palette of color. Now you have all these textures and flavors based under one animal. And that includes the inside of the animal, too. You know, tripe, you have liver, you have all these textures and flavors that you wouldn't normally think of. And how do you use these other cuts that you wouldn't normally use in a restaurant? So can you, you know, can you seam out a whole shoulder and can you serve it like a tenderloin? Yeah, you can. We do the same thing with the leg fillets.
I think it's one of the reasons that our guild has become more and more popular because there's such a joy for, especially cooks, I think, when they've been, there's a lot of repetition to working in a kitchen, and to all of a sudden be given a carcass is just, it's a thrill, it's a project. It's a totally different way of thinking for cooks and chefs to say, like, okay, here's a carcass. This has to make money. It has to be delicious. We have to have enough servings to be worthwhile mentioning to the diners.
And it's going to spoil.
What are we going to make? And it's
exactly.
Going to spoil.
Yeah, there's
and
your
you
key.
Work fast.
Yeah, and you got
to
work
have
fast.
To store it.
You got to have a plan. Plan to work, work your plan.
There's a certain stress with that whole animal. You have to, it really reflects on how the old school butchers did it, and you can see why the butcher's hours are early in the morning, and they kind of get off in the afternoon because that's the coldest part of the day. Processing an animal on the farm, you don't have the luxury of just dealing with one. You're usually dealing with quite a few, so you need space. There's an inherent stress, and you want to go through that as quickly as possible and utilize everything, not let anything spoil. And that's when you're thinking outside the box meats, so to say. Mm-hmm. So I find it, you know, I have a tremendous more appreciation with, you know, what the old chefs and the old school butchers went through. And you kind of feel like, you know, you're walking in their footsteps.
Well, the salting, they got the salt and not a lot of refrigeration. Mm-hmm. I think the game changer for me was actually harvesting my first animal. It was a very powerful experience. Mm. And I brought a crew down with me. We went down to a farm and we harvested two kids and one adult goat. And it was a very powerful, moving experience. And it changes you. Really, really changes you. Now, every year I participate, whether it be in the 4-H turkey harvest with Jim Reichard, or, you know, I go to a farm and participate. You know, I've been to Prather Ranch and, you know, I participated in a slaughter up there. It's a very eye-opening experience every single time. You think it doesn't affect you. It does. But it also solidifies the love for the product, for the creature, for what it's giving, and also the fact that you're going to work your damnedest to make sure it gets into somebody's hands and into somebody's, you know, mouth beautifully and treated with respect. It's a game changer. I think for me that was the biggest, you know, seeing the look on young cook's eyes as processing an animal from live was, you know, for the first time, you know, and I saw myself in them. It was very, very eye-opening. And I'm sure, I mean, you've done it.
I haven't processed.
You got to get it right.
It's a scary moment.
You got to get it right, because you want to be quick for the animal. So mm-hmm.
It's a scary moment.
Well, I think that there's this insane disconnect where, you know, 98% of the meat that all of us eat is from animals that are treated like a product, even when they're alive, and they're rushed through by the thousands. They're killed by the thousands every hour. They're treated, it's, you know, atrocities could go on and on. And then, you know, there's all these stories about meat being imported from China that turns out to be rat meat. And, I mean, just, it goes on and on. And then, you know, you can see why chefs and butchers want to have a different experience. I mean, this is an animal that was alive. It's a living creature, and it's very expensive and time-consuming to raise. It's, of course, you want to treat it with respect and pass that on. But I'm wondering all the time, can we do this for the whole world? I don't know if this panel has the answers, but I'm curious what you guys think. You know, is this just a, you know, a something, well, not a fad necessarily. I mean, I think that it probably will go on in some capacity, but is it just a privilege of the wealthy to have this sort of precious experience that's beautiful? But how do we change the wheels of commerce? Can we? What's the next step?
It's changed a lot just in the past 5 years, hugely, from, you know, buying, like, you know, driving all the way up to Marin to go throw a pig in the back of my chef's car because she couldn't go, so I'd borrow it, and we were like one of the only few in San Francisco, besides maybe Chris or some people in East Bay, that getting whole animals, and now it's, I mean, it's all over, and you get chefs all over getting whole animals, and they're getting delivered in, and so it's definitely like happening, not just here in Chicago, New York,
the supply meeting the demand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the supply is now coming up to the demand, and yeah, it's definitely expensive, you know, for us to, you know, I sit down and try to figure out costs, and I'm like, oh, man, shit, so sorry. Right? You know,
I can't believe we made it this far.
I know.
Four butchers. I swear.
Yeah. I was thought it would be him. what it comes back to is just that education, and that's what I love about being in the butcher shop and teaching the classes is you know, talking to the customers and trying to make it, you know, realize that you'll come more often and buy less. You know, it doesn't have to be, you don't have to buy like the $100 ribeye, it's because you're ahead every day, even though I'm not going to tell you no. But, you know, for me as like an owner, to say, oh, come every, you know, buy less, you know, spend $15 and come every other day. So you're, you know, buying what you need, you know, because that's what we want. And just kind of like educating and kind of changing the system a little bit. And as bigger markets come on, like, you know, your Whole Foods and all those type of you know, grocers, you know, it's definitely changing, but there is the majority of the public that just really can't afford everything as well too, because I mean, all these terms that warrant more higher costs and stuff, that's, you know, for marketing and, you know,
labels,
thank you. Mm-hmm. Which isn't that big deal to us. I just want to be able to talk to the farmer. I want to be able to know where it's coming from. I want to know from beginning to end. That's the only thing that's really important to us. So I think it's going to change, continuing and grow, and where is it going to end? I don't know, but I know in my world, it's definitely changed. Going to continue.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have seen a change, but
I think all of us would also tell all of our customers to eat less meat, which is funny coming from people who are making money off of selling meat. So, I mean, I think that's true. Like the consumer sort of perception or expectation of meat eating, in my opinion, is totally off the charts, being unrealistic. You know, we don't need to eat a pound of meat when we sit down and have a steak, or, you know, that's mm-hmm. a big part of unrealistic expectations for our abilities to eat responsibly.
Mm-hmm. I think if the public in the United States was able to grasp the concept of eating more than just skeletal cuts, we would be able to feed more with higher quality of meats.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the biggest hurdle that we fight every day. What are your cuts today? So when on my menu it says lamb, and every day I have to tell my staff what cuts it is. Whether it's a leg fillet in a zampini, which is just a little curly Q sausage, or it's a chop, or it's a braised shoulder, or some days I'm serving a piece of lamb liver with, you know, a piece of leg fillet. And pretty much 75% of the time, as soon as there's a liver or a kidney on the plate, sales halt. It's like somebody just went from 90 to zero, just dead stop. And they'll order these cuts as appetizers, but you're finding that people are inherently a fear of these cuts that they don't understand. It automatically goes to personal issues, whether it's a texture issue, or they had it poorly made from their grandmother, or poorly made from a friend, or they think they don't like it, but yet they've never really tried it made properly. And what that's done is created a feeding system of feedlots, mass production of meat, so that we can all eat wealthy, which is skeletal cuts. And that all came from the demise of when we won World War II. Everybody, we are now a prosperous nation. We helped win the war. And we were forced to eat these cuts of meat with our rationing stamps during World War II. That was the change. So my mother will not touch it. She is a product of that generation. Then you skip the generation and you come to our generation, and we're more apt to try these cuts of meat because this is what...
We never had them.
We never had them. But my mother, tongue, oh my God, that's horrifying. It's gross. Because those were what were called meat without joints. And you could get more meat without joints with a rationing stamp. So what would give you maybe 8 ounces of meat would give you a pound of meat to feed your family. And that's a lot during those times. So one stamp to get a pound, or one stamp to get a little bit of 8 ounces of meat. So we have this perception in this country that these cuts are for the poor. And instantly, nobody wants to be tied in with that. God forbid we be tied in with the poor. You know, God forbid we eat those cuts of meat that are looked at as impoverished meats. Those are actually healthier for you, and they have a lot more flavor and texture. So if the country can get over its issues of that, then we're going to start seeing the ability for everybody to have sustainably raised meat and have different cuts of it. It doesn't all have to be a T-bone. It doesn't have to be a porterhouse. It doesn't have to be filet. If everybody knew what a filet did, they might think second about rushing over to get one. Does everybody know what a filet does?
I love that you you share this. This cracked me up.
Go for it.
The filet is actually the muscle that pushes the excrement out of the animal.
That would officially be called a turd pusher. So when someone goes out to eat and they go and get themselves, I'm going to have that 8-ounce filet with a lobster tail on it. Awesome. I'm glad you snubbed your nose at every other cut because you think that one's so bad. No wonder why it has no flavor and it's super soft, because it works once a day. Hey, you know, and you start thinking about these whole animals. We had, you know, beef heart, I think, is a perfect example, right? I don't consider that an organ. It's actually a red muscle, right? It is used nonstop. If all of yours stopped, well, that would be a really interesting newspaper story tomorrow. But when you think about that, there's no intermuscular fat, the texture's crunchy, and we have this really beautiful flavor profile from it. So the first time I served it as a grillable cut of meat, we had a 92-year-old woman come in for her birthday, lived in the neighborhood, grandchildren brought her in. She came up to the window, you know, the pass, and I was cooking on the line, and I was like, oh no, I'm going to get it. Thinking this 93-year-old woman is going to yell at me. And she told me that the beef heart tasted like what beef tasted like when she was a little girl. It was a worked animal. It was an animal that had allowed to live its full life, was used on the farm, and that's what beef should taste like. That made my day. That was the end-all, be-all. That sold me. And that was the first week I worked at Encanto. That's a game changer. But if we can all think like that, I mean, I know Ryan serves it. I know you serve it. I know you serve it. We all serve these cuts. But it's getting the public's perception over the fear of these cuts of meat. We're the only country that doesn't eat like that. We're the only one.
Just goes back to education, just continuing it and talking to everybody. And
I want to repeat what our cameo celebrity butcher, Dave the Butcher, in the audience said. For those in the listening audience, the filet is actually the muscle that pushes the excrement out, which he stated so beautifully.
You were polite, man. I mean, awesome.
So equating quality
the
way that an animal is raised rather than the cut is one thing that could change to if more people were using more of the animal, then maybe we would all eat better. So that's one thing we're talking about. I think also Tia and Ryan could probably speak to this well, having worked a butcher counter. Most people don't know how to cook anymore, so part of the fear might not just be that they had a bad experience with something, but they just have no idea how to cook it.
Absolutely.
Like, how much time do you spend telling people how to cook stuff?
A lot, and that's why people keep coming back. You know, we do certain things for them and cut things a certain way, which would definitely, you know, we like to cut things really thick. So, you know, now I'm kind of contradicting when I say buy less. When I'm going to tell you, we like to give people more. But but when it comes to cooking, you know, I can go all into that. But, yeah, it's definitely important to spend a lot of time with customer and talk about how to cook it. How to season it is important, you know. A lot of the things that we'll tell people is not exactly what you would find in a culinary term book, I guess. you know, temperatures, leaving stuff out to temper, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, it's a big part of it. It's key, and that's what I love about it.
Well, I think for us, we were really afraid when we opened the shop that people were going to be accepting of the fact that we didn't always have every cut all the time. So something I've said a lot is that, you know, what surprised me was that our customers were a lot more flexible than we thought they were going to be. And actually, it ended up being a really special thing that to be able to recommend different cuts to them, because when that happens, you've sort of made a friend, or you've gained somebody, your customer's trust, and so they're going to come back to you, and it's not something to be afraid of. It's actually kind of a really nice bonus to the fact that you are cutting it, but you also know how to prepare it, and that's, you know, the difference between a small, you know, a small butcher shop and shopping in a supermarket, and so.
And then it makes you realize how large a community you're in, because these folks are coming and seeking you out for these things. Like, we saw a lot of blood sausage. I would have took a long time to make blood sausage because I didn't think anybody would buy it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're just a lot of blood sausage, a lot of, like, tongue pastrami, you know, a lot of things that, you know, a lot of cuts in the forequarter that, you know, we wouldn't sell when we first opened, that we just, they sell faster than, you know, ribeyes and strips. And so, yeah, it's cool.
So, not to beat a dead cow, but
I'd like to beat a dead horse. When is that going to be legal?
But I think of you guys as, you're a little bit of a petri dish. I mean, you're at the forefront of something that's been happening, and you've been doing this longer than a lot of other people have been doing. So you've tried a lot of things. You know all the farmers in the area. You've been through many evolutions of buying whole animals. And are there things that you can see in the future that might make it possible for you to sell your products cheaper? Like, are there, you know, what could make it possible for you to sell to a wider audience?
I think the whole meat industry is actually starting to take notice, because when we're buying these whole animals from the small to medium farms, we're spending quite a bit compared to the large lot farms. But you're seeing these larger companies now starting to advertise, like for in the pig industry, you know, straight Duroc, Berkshire Duroc blend, and, you know, they're jumping on the marketing campaign. But what they're actually doing is they're seeing this movement, especially with the younger generation, you know, demanding this and paying for their product, and they're going to follow the money, not to mention the beef industry, the pork, the chicken. It's all federally subsidized, and that's not sustainable, and that's not going to last forever. And so these companies are saying, wow, you know, instead of getting my 79 cents per pound for the hog, you know, these medium farmers, they're getting $3.50 to $5 a pound, and they're going to follow the money. So they're actually starting to watch and see what's going on. Change is it takes time, especially these days. You think everything's so quick these days, but it really doesn't work that way. But I think within 10 to 15 years, we're going to see a change going on, and it's all about money with this economy that we're in, and that could be for the better. And plus, I think you mentioned it a year or two ago, like the American family, they spend what, like 11 or 10%.
We pay the least in the world.
And Europe is like 17 or 18%, or maybe
least.
More.
Yep.
And
it's like flip flop from insurance to food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
Insurance is more, and food is less.
Yeah, well, it's taken a full generation to see the effects on our health as well, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so that also is something that's come about, and that people are paying attention to, and that, you know, that's not saving anyone any money.
Quality of life. I don't foresee the price decreasing on meat. Mm-hmm. I actually see it rising, because being able to continue to produce top quality, clean, never, you know, heritage breed animals is going to be very difficult for these large companies to make that switch.
Sure.
And what's going to happen is we're paying premium to buy top quality. So what's going to happen is it's all going to come to that level. And then what you'll see, well, the way I see it, man, you know, mine's a pretty narrow way, I think you're going to see people using animal fats to cook vegetables. So they're getting an animal protein on a vegetable. They're getting the flavor profiles, but they're not having, per se, as much meat. It's almost, it's very similar to the way that I had food in Hong Kong, where it was very minimal amounts of meat, or it was duck fat, or it was animal fat, or it was just chicken wings blasted in there with some vegetables. It made a major flavor transformation of what it was being served with, but the meat was the minimal portion. And I think that's going to be the normal way that we're going to start to see meat. And, I mean, who am I to talk? I'm pretty notorious for destroying people when they come into the restaurant, you know, serving a whole pig's foot stuffed with, you know, pig's feet and sweetbreads and foie gras. But that's not that I was
what?
I haven't done that in a while. God, I missed that. But I think that's what we're going to see the future lead towards. I think whole roast animals will become a special event for large groups, or bigger cuts of meat will be shared items for, you know, two people or four people. Like, we're doing dishes for two at the restaurant, and it's one hock. We do it, we joke around, we call it toe knee hock. And it's trotter cakes with the big hock and a huge salad and lots of vegetables with it to try to get people to share and have this communal dining experience on one piece of meat that's really rich and luscious. And that's really transformed the way people have been eating in the restaurant. So that's the way I see it going. I don't foresee prices on pigs and meats coming down. I actually see it almost leveling off, and we're going to see more people do, you know, the proper animal rearing.
Yeah,
I hope.
I don't see it going down. I just see people getting smarter about their purchases and cooking, like you're kind of talking about, and buying lesser cuts and all that. So
bugs.
We do this.
Bugs. Sure.
I've eaten cricket tacos. Yeah. Those are good, but I don't foresee me eating any mealworms anytime soon. Maybe at the bottom of a mezcal bottle or something.
Yeah.
You're not going to butcher
no comment.
Bugs. No comments.
If you have to butcher a bug, that's going to be one Tyrannosaurus bug. Like, what are you going to...
Yeah, no thanks.
I draw the line.
Bugs are kind of happening in Europe. I just read that there's, you know, been some legal changes where they've been they're not considered anymore like an agricultural byproduct. They're considered food, and so they're starting to create, you know, meal out of it, basically.
So is horse, but, you know, we can't get over that hurdle here in this country.
Like a bug nugget, and then just like
bug nuggets.
Bug birds.
I mean, unfortunately,
what is that, like cockroaches? Or, I mean, what is that?
Yeah, they're all kinds of
mealworms. I saw their cicada recipes. Everybody's all excited about cicada recipes because they're going to have the biggest cicada, you know, infestation in the East Coast.
Eating what's available. I mean, it's kind of along the same lines. I wonder how much of your work every day is mission-based. I mean, is that what gets you up in the morning? Is it just the pleasure of doing what you do? How much of your drive is about changing the world? Do you think about it that much? Do you, you know, 51% of the greenhouse gases in the world are from agricultural production. I'm sure that animal agriculture. I'm sure that the farms that you buy from are probably not contributing to that. Like, is that part of your mission to change the world? Is it that big for you guys?
I think a strong community can change the world. So, you know, do I think that it's going to happen tomorrow? No, but, I mean, every day that's what we do. So, you know, now it's just what we do. I don't know.
Every small effort makes a difference. And, yeah, I mean, I think that it's a lot more inspiring to be passionate about what you're doing than, I mean, we all have to work really hard. So it's easier to do if you believe in what you're working for.
Yeah, I mean, all of you are probably doing things differently 10, 15 years ago, but you made a switch. I would imagine that part of it is mission-based. Is it about connecting with the community? Is that like
Lily, I was going to say, it's because everybody that's here right now that we're able to do this because of the support of the, you know, community Bay Area definitely a switch for me at some point, you know, but every day it's get up and stay true to what we do, and that's why we have solid team and great customers.
I mean, ultimately, the goal every day, can you go home and look yourself in the mirror? If you can't come home from work and look yourself in the mirror and be honest with yourself, say, you know, John and I were just down in Monterey Bay Aquarium cooking together down there and, you know, trying to help, you know, look at what's going on in the ocean, the acidification. It's like, oysters all died last year. That's why the oysters, you know, it's like, there's so much to look at. It's like, is my child, is our children going to have things in the future? What are they going to be able to ever really experience or share with their children the same luxuries that we had when we were a kid? And yes, I call them luxuries. Whether it be an oyster or a fried clam or a piece of steak, like, are they going to be able to share those luxuries with them when they have children? And I think that, you know, we can go home and, you know, I think about what we do on the menu and, you know, who I buy from. You know, I know where my produce is coming from. I know where my meat's coming from. We try to do the best we can every day to make our guests happy, to educate my staff, keep my staff happy. And, you know, I think that's the best we can do every day, you know. Speak up as much as we can. Don't preach. Preaching, all it does is piss people off.
Or at least practice what you preach.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And I think, you know, just, you know, like I say, if I can go home and look myself in the mirror, then I did okay.
So when you're at serving food at a rock concert, are 15-year-olds in halter tops wondering where their lamb is from?
We try to tell them. sometimes they're on another level.
they're trying to get their drunk off.
Yeah. But, you know, like at these music festivals, some that I do, it's amazing that this younger generation, and they're actually really fueling this whole, you know, they're sustaining this movement for us. But, like, I'm, for example, butchering a whole lamb and breaking it down to cooked at this time. And they are, like, you know, it's kind of a shock and awe, but they are absolutely in awe, like, oh, my gosh, I've never seen anything like that. And then they get the smell, see, and then they get the taste. And that's a very powerful, memorable experience. And that actually is one of my, you know, practice what you preach. That's kind of keeps me going. You know, food memories are quite powerful and quite long-lasting. And that's something special when you can do that as a chef, a cook, restaurateur, butcher. And then, you know, one of my favorite, you know, bigger festivals is the Eat Real. Just love the whole concept of it. Kind of street food, reasonably priced, and there's nothing over $5. And yet a massive amount of people show up. Facilitators, you know, and they really make you source your ingredients within like a 100-mile radius. And just to see like 300,000 people go through your booth in a 3-day period. I mean, it's a lot of work, a lot of planning, talk about like reaching the people, and they remember you. And so, you know, going through that extra effort, you know, I believe is worth it. And then, you know, they say, oh, you're the guy who did the lamb, and, you know, fringe benefit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a nice fringe benefit for me, so.
Do all of your kids love meat? Are they comfortable with the carcass?
My son eats sausage and hot dogs pretty much every day. and pizza. He likes pizza.
My daughter has sawed a pig's leg off and can trim the inside of a pig. So that's pretty
nice.
Cool. Yeah. I have video of it. It cracks me up.
That's awesome.
We went to a petting zoo the other day, and my son was like, Dad, don't cut him.
Yeah. I got that for a long time.
Yeah.
I was told I wasn't allowed to harvest small animals. They had to have lived and had a happy time. And so, but now he'll eat anything.
But it is so important for kids, too, to have exposure to that because, you know, I grew up eating boneless, skinless chicken breast, and I didn't even know that chicken had bones in it until I was like 12 years old, because all my mom cooked was boneless, skinless chicken breast and broccoli. And it just, you know, my daughter having been exposed to it, it just really opens your experiences and will dictate the food choices that they make for the rest of their lives. And it's really important.
So I think it's time for some audience questions. There's a mic there.
Over there.
So line up at the mic so that our extended audience can hear you. And yes, sir.
Hello, my name is Tim. Each one of you on the panel has an iconic eatery of your own. And every day you see people coming into your eateries, ordering the things that you're specialized for, taking a picture of it, spending minutes like color correcting it, then posting it to every single social network they possibly can. Do you guys feel that this focus on the image or the experience of the image of sharing this food takes away from the actual enjoying of the food? And at what point does that celebration of the image just become so much food masturbation?
I am definitely a social media machine. I use Instagram, Vine, and Twitter, but I think it's a great medium to share with the world what you're doing. I think you cannot stop anybody from taking pictures in your restaurant. Doesn't matter anymore. Do I think it'd be nice if people ate the food while it was hot? Sure, because pasta waits for no one, right? So if you come in and you get a pasta, it's really beautiful, the sauce is great, and they get to sit there. And then they change the settings on their Instagram because they don't like what color shade it's in, and they're taking. By the time they eat it, then I get that shit Yelp post that's, oh, my pasta was cold. Well, of course it's cold. You just spent 20 minutes taking a freaking picture of it. But that's not going to go away. We can't change that because that's what that little device has created. That device has created instant gratification to the world, right? How many times have you all looked at your phones today? How many times have you checked your Instagram? Or who's doing what on Facebook? Or who's doing what on Twitter? And it's the same thing with food. Everybody wants to know what everybody else is doing. Ryan uses it, and he can push out what's coming up to the market, right?
I mean, we work really hard, so I gotta let you know. Otherwise,
nobody's going to show. John does it for events. Tia does it. These are the cuts that are super great right now. Please come to the shop or check out what we're doing at Sociale. And it's a way to reach the public because how else are you going to reach everybody? It's the best, easiest way to get in touch with us because we're doing our own. I mean, I answer as many as I can. It can be a little ridiculous, but I think there's a point of it where it's important for us to do it. Do I think I don't do it when I go out to dinner? No. I think that's the difference. Do you do it when you go out to dinner?
No, I don't think so. I don't know.
I mean,
sometimes if it's.
I can't believe anyone
amazing,
would care
but,
what I'm eating for
but
dinner.
But I'm also just like.
Yeah, and then you shovel.
I'm not really worried too much. I'm not the food stylist yet.
As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's In Forum, Connect Your Intellect. And tonight we're hosting Eating Nose to Tail, the whole animal movement with experts and innovators.
Man, you do good commercials.
Mm. Thank you.
Hi, thanks for speaking with all of us today about butchery. And so I actually own a commercial kitchen in Oakland, and so we have a lot of space for butchery. And one thing that has been requested of our kitchen is to have a butchery class, right? But we don't actually, I don't know how to butcher anything except for a chicken. And I think that's as limited as I can go. But I had an idea about just buying a whole pig from a local farm and then bringing people in to chop it up themselves. So how important is it to know all the different cuts of the animal? Because I know in a pig roast, they just hack at it. You
kinda
take whatever
important
piece they give you, right? And so how important is it? Like, can I just bring in a team and we could just bring knives?
Well,
and
that depends on
it?
What kind of experience you want to have.
Yeah.
You know?
if you're calling it a
butchery class, then you need a butcher. But if you're, say, want to come hack up a pig, then that could be that class.
You got your own Walking Dead episode.
Yeah.
You know?
Which, you know, you learn something.
What's not intuitive about it? I mean, what is your... all of your knowledge bring to bear?
I mean, well, you have to know what you're doing to some degree.
Yeah,
you could read a book.
Yeah.
You know, read diagrams, watch videos on YouTube, right? There's a lot of resources
a lot
out
of resources
there. You could read
there.
The book I wrote. No,
I mean, there's a lot more resources, I think, than when we all started.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of books
zero
out there.
Yeah, Beth basically just taught myself how to do it and my peers, but just kind of cutting them, knowing what cuts looked like from just somewhere, grocery stores, I guess, or working in restaurants by buying box meat. We teach a lot of classes, and the first thing we tell everybody is just remember that this is all edible. So enjoy yourself, have fun, don't get stressed too much about the right cuts and stuff like that. But yeah, you definitely have a general idea of where the pork chop's coming from, you know. But definitely want to just, you know, it's all edible. So
there are definitely lots of books and information out there with specifications that are probably easy to follow on how an animal's sectioned.
Okay.
Most certainly.
Ryan's book has great photographs of all the different cuts and the process. And I think that's a really, really great book to look at for that.
What's the name of the book?
Whole Beast Butchery. It's 500 pictures of how to butcher a beef, lamb, and pork.
Oh, nice.
And great recipes with the cuts, too.
Yeah,
it's
recipes. Yeah. And there's not a lot, so they're all really good. Mm-hmm.
But it's really, I think, especially the color photographs, the really detailed, are going to guide you through that process. I mean, way that you learned, and the way that you learned, and the way that you learned, and the way that I learned, I'm sure everybody has a different, like, I lied to learn how to butcher an animal. I told somebody I knew what I was doing. And then I went and bought a veterinarian guide. So I learned muscle structure by a veterinarian guide. I still have all the pages marked in the house. Mm-hmm. My wife laughs at me. She thinks I'm crazy.
It's okay. You are.
I am. But we all learn a different way. And I think that, but with Ryan's book and the great photographs of the step-by-step and your cuts and your final product, that's going to give you what you need.
Thank you so much.
Don't hack up a pig, please.
So it's like intimidating to deal with a whole animal. So it's really nice to hear that you are all amateurs when you first.
Oh yeah, well I started with a rabbit. You know, rabbit's same structure as a lamb, as a pig, as beef. Mm-hmm. So you really could just get a rabbit. You know, it's the same size as a chicken. You know, like 2 to 3, 4 pounds, and just kind of start there, or start with a 4-quart of a lamb. Or a leg of lamb and just kind of
practice,
work your way.
Like
you could also
deboning.
Take a class at Avedano's, Tia's shop, or from 4505 Meats. They teach classes.
There's a lot of classes out there now. It's great.
Oh, okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you can, and you learn so much by just looking, and it's something wonderful when you see like a real butcher, and they can just go through that pig or go through that lamb so quickly and almost effortlessly, and then. And then, you know, you just kind of take it from there.
Okay. Well, if you ever hear about some pig hacking classes,
well, then you do whole hog sausage.
Yep. It's expensive.
Yeah. How you doing? My name's Adam. I'm curious, there's been so much talk about expense and the cost of what you guys do. I should caveat this. This is a little self-serving on my part. I own a meat company up in the North Bay. I'm not here to promote it. But what I do is commercial animals that are raised better. And so I'm curious, we've talked a lot about the expense of meat and heritage breeds. And I love the concept of saving the heritage breeds and everything. But when we talk about affordability, I think that there's a lot of room for growth and for affordability in dealing with things like, and the chicken's the easiest example, where you have a Cornish cross chicken that is what Foster Farms or Tyson and all those people raise, that if you can raise it better, you can serve it in a better way and make it a little more affordable. I'm curious as to how you guys approach those type of animals as opposed to heritage breeds. I think there's a place for both, and I'm just curious how you guys feel
Could
about that.
Could you just clarify like what you mean by better?
If you can take what's raised commercially, people look at the Cornish cross and they say that chicken will never be viable because it's got such a huge breast and it's bred to fall down and it'll never support its legs. Yet if you raise it outside in the sunshine, the fresh air, on pasture, you can get a really viable bird. It's never going to be a freedom ranger, but it's going to be a really viable bird with really great breast meat, really great fat, really incredible flavor that's not going to take 12, 14 weeks to raise.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make
sense?
So
not raised in a cage, maybe?
No, chicken tractors out on pasture,
right.
That kind of thing.
I think it ultimately boils down to walking out there and taking a look.
And how's it taste?
Yep.
You know, that's important to us, you know.
I mean, if it's being fed crap meal, well, then you're going to get a crap product, you know, and it's just not right. But I think, you know, I prefer to go look where, you know, just like John's done and everybody here's done. I like to look at where all my products are coming from. And I think that's really, you know, the end-all be-all.
Cool. Thanks.
I would like to say, you're talking about the chickens, you know, on the larger farms. The chickens is definitely, you know, a lot more tender. They're a little bit more confined, and you understand, as I said, you understand like the old school butchers and the old school chefs, like with the chicken, on the free range chickens, they're a little more tougher, and especially that thigh and leg meat. And you understand where, you know, the French came up with coq au vin, and it's a great application, you know, a nice 3-4 hour cooking, and you tenderize that. But a lot of people are kind of off put, you know, with you know, the chicken that's kind of like a mainstream meat, with the free range chicken, one, with the price, and two, with the taste, it's just a little bit tougher. But if you know what you're doing, and you can coax it out and tenderize it, but that takes time and effort and thinking. But I approach, you know, the commodity meat and the heritage and smaller farm meat the same way. I try to, you know, to treat it the same. I don't discriminate.
I'm going to challenge you, John. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think that I think that what you just said there is a perfect capsule of some of the things that we struggle with in the ag industry in terms of changing this perception that Chris was talking about in terms of eating Oregon meat or eating the lesser cuts or whatever. It's a perception issue. I've got Cornish cross that will make you forget about coq au vin. And not me personally, but you know, in general, I think that if you raise an animal outside in the sunshine and the fresh air and feed it a good feed, it doesn't have to be tough. It's not free range. It's pastured. That's a huge distinction. And I think that you guys, with the pulpit that you guys have, I want you guys to experience that and have that. I know you have to a certain extent. When you talk about heritage, that's where people, I think, get caught up in breed specific and purebreds and everything. My wife is dead set in terms of raising heritage breeds to save the heritage breeds, which is awesome. But I think for the common people, we need to understand that there's a better way to raise Cornish cross, or there's a better way to raise Berkshire Duroc cross pigs.
I think that we would all agree that it's important to not get super religious about our beliefs and to everything on its own terms and be open to good solutions, whether they're, you know, the end all be all or somewhere in between. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks.
One thing that we have a thing in this country that I think we kind of forget about every day, and it's really important. We have the best teeth on the planet. Okay? And I had a great, great friend come in, and he's been very fortunate enough to travel the world, and talks about how we're so concerned about everything being so tender, so super, super, super tender. And you go to these countries where people have maybe one tooth in their head, and all they want is texture. They want to chew that meat. They want something that has
that tooth.
It's toothsome. It's not about using the tooth. It's about extracting the most flavor from it. And I think we've gotten so hung up on everything being so tender. We've crossbred. Everything's been bred to be tender and soft and mealy. We've forgot what textured meat is. Like if you cook, for instance, say just like an octopus, and it's just a little toothsome. Oh my God, it's the toughest thing I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
I can't chew this. Or if it's a steak and it has anything in it, like a bit of sinew, which anywhere else would be fine. Then they flip. And
people complain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's
and
crazy.
There's nothing wrong with toothsomeness or having, you know, a little bit of bite to your food. It actually, I think that's also what we're talking about with, like, you know, grass fed, you know, or pasture-raised birds are going to have a different feel to them, a different mouth. You know, I think that you chew those animals, you chew that meat, and it's going to give you a better flavor. It's going to draw them all out. So.
And it makes you enjoy it, and you're not consuming as much, too.
Exactly.
Eating slower. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Eating slower, mm-hmm. Eating less. You're being satiated with less meat.
Mm-hmm. This will be our last question.
Thank you guys for coming. I was wondering, there's a question for any of you. What would you tell, or what have you found is an effective thing to tell a small child who is afraid of or disturbed by eating meat because they really like the animals that it comes from?
Ooh.
I don't know. My son hasn't asked yet.
I face this at dinner all the time with my stepdaughter, who's 10, and I just tell her that she's Right. Most animals aren't treated well. We always try to buy meat from animals that are treated well and try to talk about the food chain with her that we win, I guess. But also, if you don't want to eat it, if it makes you sad, don't eat it. Food shouldn't make you sad. You want to be a vegetarian? Like, that's okay. Butchers aren't evil. And we're actually thinking more about meat and how animals are treated and treating them better than probably anybody else, even though we're serving meat, you know?
If you push the subject, you'll lose.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, it
don't
push.
You're basically coming, you're headbutting with somebody who has way more time to think about it than you do. And you're not going to win, right? So let them go through their phase, and it'll switch. But always, we in my house, we always have what's called one no thank you bite, and we just leave some there. And if he tries it and he says he doesn't like it, why? Texture, bitter, salty, sweet, too strong, you know, so there's an answer instead of it just being, I don't like that, which is most kids. I don't like it. I hate it. It's gross.
Help him think about it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So you create a dialogue that you can then kind of weave the appropriate information in, but you're not going to win.
Yeah, don't fight it.
If you force it, forget it. It's like those kids who never eat peas for the rest of their life because their mom made them sit there and eat a whole bowl. Don't do it.
No peas.
It's the informed tradition to end all of our events with the following question. Chris, Ryan, John, and Tia, what are your 60-second ideas to change the world?
Oof.
No pressure.
For me, it's just to continue doing, you know what we're doing, and just know that what we're doing for, you know, my family and it's because we love what we do. And just continue that education to everybody that we talk to. And there is no, if somebody doesn't want to eat meat, it's not a big deal. You know, it's just everybody can have their own beliefs, and this is ours. And if you want to hop on our train, let's go.
Ride it.
There's beer.
There's beer, too.
And hot dogs.
Yes.
My answer to that question would be, you know, the Butchers Guild. I believe that, you know, connecting people who are passionate and talented and creative in the meat industry is really important. It's really inspiring to me. And I think building pride around all of the extra work that people do in this industry is really important. And so to me, it's just continuing that work and giving people sort of the recognition that they deserve for taking the extra steps in the industry.
Yeah, I think, to tag with that, practice what I preach, and the education aspect, which is so big and sometimes so overlooked. But, going out there and talking with the people, once I start talking, they can understand my passion, and it becomes contagious. And that's,
telling your story.
Yeah, exactly. Getting personal with it. And just continue going. So,
I think cooking from here, from my heart, and not cooking just for my head. Saying thank you every day, and trying to have more fun. You know, don't sweat the small shit. It ain't worth it. You know, we're very fortunate to be living where we are and doing what we do, and we're in the business of making people happy. How cool is that? We don't have to go sit at a desk in front of a computer and put zeros and ones together to make something work on your phone. We get to enjoy it.
I do that.
Although that's
no,
a
those are dollars.
That's
dollar signs that we wear. We have to do the math every day to make sure we can pay our bills and employees.
Ryan's like, that's what I do.
I think that it's there's something to be said for being hospitable and convivial. And making it fun every day. For crying out loud, we're feeding people. It's the best job in the world. I wouldn't change it.
Feeding families, not just people.
Yeah.
Well, on that note of gratitude, let's give a big round of applause to Chris, Ryan, John, and Tia for sharing their thoughts with us tonight. And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Please hold your seats for a second. There'll be further directions for the premium ticket holders.